This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle Speak, back from the trail for a bit. We really appreciate you taking time today for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that is joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room where I see Lee is already sitting at the front row. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest in the next hour, that's the perfect place to put it because I'll be there monitoring it as we go forward. And for today's show, we're going to look at an interesting crossing of ideas that took place last month, because it has become very apparent that though there was an aspiration starting in 2016 to get our Navy to 355 and more, that has faded well beyond the horizon. And we need to look at other measures that we can use to expand maritime power, presence, and influence, because the requirements are still there as the premier maritime power. And one of the possible ways that we can do that is to look at ways that we can better expand integration, support, and interoperability with our own Coast Guard as part of that answer. We brought on today a guest that I think is going to be spot on for today's topic. I wish we had had him on before, but hey, better late than never. Our guest is going to be Chuck Hill. Chuck is a graduate of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy back in 1969 and retired in 1991. He is, well, at least in my opinion, is one of the premier Coast Guard-focused bloggers out there, and you can find him over at chuckhillscgblog.net. Chuck, welcome to Midrats.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you on board. And as I kind of mentioned in the introduction, the timing was great because mid-month last month, Undersecretary of the Navy Moseley, he gave a speech over at the Professional Services Council. And, you know, part of his, and I'll do a little pull quote from the Undersecretary, quote, "We had a goal of a 355-ship Navy, and I'll tell you it's going to be very, very difficult," unquote. And then shortly thereafter, you step forward and thinks the Coast Guard can be part of the solution. Outline for us a little bit, what do you think some of the major areas that our Coast Guard might be in a position to help?
Well, this isn't really a new idea. The Coast Guard has been sort of a naval auxiliary in virtually every war. World War II, we manned a bunch of Navy and Army ships, 30 DEs, 75 frigates, 76 LSTs, 288 Army craft. We expanded quite a bit, of course, and cutters, sank U-boats, escorted convoys, very successfully in the Atlantic. And then in the Pacific, we use the same cutters, were converted to amphibious force flagships, and were involved in landings in the Pacific as well as the Atlantic. We've got about 41,000 active duty people. And, you know, there's all those jokes about us being smaller than the New York City Police Department, but we're also bigger than the Royal Navy or the French Navy. We're building new ships. the national security cutters, Berthoff class, are 4,500 tons. That's just a little bit bigger than the FFGs. And they have a lot of the characteristics of a frigate. They do better than 28 knots. I've heard that they've done 32. They've got the Airbus TRS 3D multimode radar, same as on the Freedom class LCS, 57 millimeter gun, Slick 32 Victor 2. They've got a skiff. They've got NBC Citadel, that sort of thing. We're building 11 of those. 8 of them are already commissioned. Then we're building 25 offshore patrol cutters. They call it the Heritage class. They're going to be about 3,700 tons. I suspect they may actually be closer to 4,000. They're about the same size as a Freedom class littoral combat ship. And they're equipped with a lot of the same equipment. They also have the 57 millimeter gun. They have the Sea Giraffe multimode radar, Slick 32 Victor 6. They have space for a skiff. I've heard that they may be actually installing the skiff. Both classes are going to have data links. Both classes have flight decks that are Navy certified. So it's not too much of a stretch to figure on modifying them so that they can escort high priority merchant ships, reinforcement, logistic shipping from the West Coast to the theater of wherever the action is happening. I don't envision them being carrier escorts, but they might work with amphibious ready groups, that sort of thing. They might use, they all have very good facilities for helicopters and facilities for unmanned aircraft. So it's not too much of a stretch, but there's going to be 25 of the offshore patrol cutters in addition to the 11 at least national security cutters. So that's 36 potential escort vessels. It doesn't look like it's too difficult to do. We're building a class of patrol boats that's not unlike the Cyclone class, about the same size, displacement, armed with the 25 millimeter Mark 38. Looks like we're going to have 64 of those. They've been very useful. They've exceeded our expectations. They have a nominal range of 2,500 miles, but they've actually deployed from Hawaii to Kwajalein and to Samoa. They've gone from Long Beach to the Pacific drug interdiction zones, up to 2,300 miles unreplenished on their own. So they're proving very useful. Range is something that Coast Guard cutters tend to have relative to their Navy counterparts. The national security cutters, the larger ones, have a range of 12,000 miles. The offshore patrol cutters, we expect to have a range of about 10,000 miles. And they're all designed with seakeeping in mind, so they tend to be, they can continue to do boat ops and helicopter ops in adverse conditions. And so maybe we can help. our buoy tenders might be used to place sensors on the ocean bottom, including maybe something like a captor mine, which was a encapsulated anti-submarine torpedo and sensors that was developed quite a while ago. But, you know, we used to wear almost the same uniform. And if you look back in some of the World War II films, unless you were very aware of how the Coast Guard uniforms were marked, you couldn't tell us from the Navy. So maybe we can help.
You know, yeah, I think you can help. I've worked with, when I was on active duty and in my reserve duties, I worked with the Coast Guard units in counter-drug operations. And during Desert Storm, I had an inshore undersea warfare unit, and we had the PSU unit assigned with us to do to be our teeth, because we were just the eyes. Very professional, very well-trained, a lot of fun people to work with. There are a lot of potential synergies. I think you've identified in this last few minutes a lot of those. But I saw on your blog post that a lot of people were kind of critical of adopting a DOD type approach as opposed to the Homeland Security approach. Can you kind of address that issue and why? I mean, what is there a distinction in those missions? Other than, you know, we could take your cutters and send them a long way escorting merchants across the ocean. But are we not kind of doing the same sort of thing, only you guys are more law enforcement oriented?
Yeah, well, I think that some of the readers don't realize the history behind it and how frequently we have actually done military ops with the Navy. The Coast Guard is a unique organization because it's not a single purpose thing. It's more of a it's got 11 different missions, and only 5 of them are considered to be Homeland Security missions. So where we fit and getting department support is always an issue. You know, we used to say we've done so much with so little for so long, we're now qualified to do everything with nothing. But we really haven't fared all that badly. A lot of people see big Navy budgets and think, you know, we should be in the Coast Guard should be under the Navy Department. But actually, the Coast Guard has enjoyed modest growth over the long period. The last few years under the Budget Control Act have been difficult, but taking a longer view, we've actually been expanding over time while the Navy Marine Corps have been contracting. You know, when I first entered the Coast Guard, the Navy was about 22 times larger than the Coast Guard. Now it's about 8.5. The Marines were 7 times bigger than the Coast Guard, and they consider themselves a small service. Now it's about 4.5 times larger. So we haven't really done that badly. But it is kind of confusing to lawmakers and the government in general, because we do so many different things, we don't neatly fit into a box, you know. If you only look at one mission, we're not that efficient. But if you look at the range of missions that we do, it would be difficult to do them all without the multi-mission characteristics of the Coast Guard.
And when you think of missions, and one of the sad things, and this isn't limited to any age group, is sometimes people's memories can get very, very, very short. But in the last few years, in two mission areas, we've seen on the Navy side of the house enhanced attention that we haven't seen in really a couple of decades. We saw it starting about 3 years ago, where concerns about ASW from the GI-UK gap to some of the interesting challenges you can have with submarines in the waters of the Western Pacific. But also, everybody wants to use the phrase lethality, or getting more anti-surface warfare capability distributed throughout the fleet. And within our living area, at least, the U.S. Coast Guard used to have that capability in a lot of their cutters. If you could for a bit, I wonder if you could do two things for us, Chuck. First of all, go back and talk about that time where they did have a limited, but it was there, ASW and anti-surface capability, including harpoons. And with the new construction ships that we have, is there enough square footage and spare displacement that if they needed to get upgunned with additional combat capability in those mission areas, that might be a possibility?
Yeah. When I joined the Coast Guard, when I first went to the Academy in 65, we had 36 cutters that were ASW equipped. And they were old. They were World War II vintage. But they did have over-the-side shot torpedoes, sonar. It wasn't a lot better than the World War II stuff, but, you know, it had aged out in its usefulness. But there were 36 of them. And about that same time, we started building the high-endurance cutters, the 378-foot class that is only now being replaced, even though that was 50 years ago. They weren't as good an ASW ship as the Navy contemporaries that were being built at the time, but they were better than a lot of the frigates, or destroyer escorts, as we called them at the time, that were in the Navy inventory. They were faster and had over-the-side torpedoes, tubes, and the Mark 38 sonar, which was a hull-mounted version of the Mark 38, or the ANSQS 36 variable depth sonar. But about in the early 70s, we took the ASW equipment off of all the older cutters, left it on the new ones that were built, class of 12. They retained that, and in the late 80s, we decided to modernize them as part of the 600-ship Navy effort, and we were equipped for LAMPS-1, had launchers for 8 harpoons, the equipment to use sonobuoys and that sort of thing. Then very shortly thereafter, the Soviet Union fell apart. And so it was the end of history, and we no longer expected any serious naval competition. So in an effort to save money, we took off all the ASW equipment. We took off the harpoons. We eliminated the sonar technician rating, which we had had for at least since World War II. You could understand why they did it at the time. But it's just that the situation has changed now. The national security cutters actually were built with space and weight reservation for 12 Mark 56 VLS tubes, which would give us 24 ESSMs, evolved Sea Sparrow missiles, anti-aircraft missiles. I think there's really room for an anti-ship missile as well, although where exactly we would put them isn't clear. The Huntington Ingalls, of course, made the national security cutters, and they put a lot of thought into this and attempted to market it as a frigate. And they placed, they showed it with VLS and anti-ship missiles and sonar of various types. I did a little look at the offshore patrol cutters, and I'm pretty sure that they have space for anti-ship cruise missiles, Mark 56 VLS launchers, and probably the, I think it's the SQR-20 that they're developing for the LCS to put on the stern. The national security cutters have got their boats arranged on the fantail right now, and there's a stern launch ramp there and an overhead crane to move boats. They can take at least two boats there. Potentially they could use those facilities for unmanned surface vessels or unmanned UUVs. So there's potential there, I think. I look at the our little patrol boat, our patrol craft that we're building now, and suspect that they could take vertical launch Hellfire as well. To use them in the same sorts of role that the Cyclone patrol craft are being used for now. In fact, we've already funded four of them as replacements for the patrol boats that are currently based in Bahrain. I suspect we'll have six, just as we have 6 110-foot patrol boats there now. So the 110s will be taken out and replaced by the 154-foot, 353-ton fast response cutter, they call it. It's a very nice little ship, very roomy bridge. The Mark 38 gun has a nice electro-optic system on it, and it's working very well for us.
Is there the potential for a culture clash between the people who've come up through the Coast Guard food chain compared to the folks in the Navy, in your view?
Well, you know, we're such a diverse organization. We have people who think of themselves exclusively as SAR people who think of themselves exclusively as Marine inspection people. But generally, the ship drivers have no problem with this. And In fact, there's some enthusiasm, I think, for better preparing the ships for combat. Also, I think that we may not be fully prepared to deal with the possibility of a terrorist attack. The weapons that we've got, typically the M2 50 caliber machine gun and the 25 millimeter gun, they're not adequate for dealing with a terrorist attack if it involved a medium to large ship. And if it involves a highly maneuverable, fast, small craft, there's a good possibility that we'd have collateral damage from that sort of weapon. So I favor some guided weapons for dealing with those threats so that we have some assurance that we're going to hit the target first time and take it out with one round if possible. The weapon I'd really like to see for dealing with the medium to large terrorist threat is a lightweight torpedo that would take out the props and immobilize the ship. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. I know the Mark 46 Mod 5 was supposed to have an anti-surface capability, so maybe you could use that. The Swedes have got a lightweight torpedo, 400 millimeter wire-guided that's usable against surface and subsurface targets, which might be good, but if we don't have that, if we don't have, and those could go on patrol boats, you know, that are always available in all the many ports that we have. If we don't have that, then at least putting anti-ship cruise missiles on the larger cutters, we might be in place to target a terrorist attack with those. And then it would also be usable for the distributed lethality problem. I would really like to see LRASM because of the range and because of the size of the warhead. But naval strike missile would be an improvement, certainly. Plus, our ships go places that your ships don't usually go, into the Bering Sea and that sort of thing. So we would actually, there's a good chance we would have a ship closer to the Russian Pacific Fleet than the Navy would, if it came to that. You know, so
we've kind of touched on a few of the challenges I think you'd run into in expanding the missions. You know, obviously there's some equipment issues, personnel issues, and maybe even a mindset. But our friend Lee brought up a point in the chat room that kind of flowed into the question that I wanted to put out there before we ended the show. And that has to do with roles and missions. If we decide to lean on the Coast Guard without a really appreciable increase in budget to ask them to help the Navy out in a variety of areas, there's a question about the missions that the Coast Guard is doing right now. And, you know, what would they have to not do? And are there other state, local, or even federal entities that could backfill the Coast Guard on some of its present roles and missions if the Navy needed them to step forward? And I know the Coast Guard's had to make this compromise in the past because the Coast Guard have sent people forward in pretty every conflict we have. What would be some of the concerns there?
Okay, well, first off, the Navy pays for the weapons and sensors like sonar and anti-ship cruise missiles and that sort of thing that the Coast Guard uses. Now, there'd probably be some minor additions to the crews of the ship to do the maintenance and operation of these. But we're not actually talking about deploying on a regular basis in support of these. We're talking about coming to the aid of the Navy in a major conflict where we're naturally going to adjust our priorities when it's an existential threat. The difference in the operating costs for the vessels is going to be relatively small. You might have to increase the crew about 10 people, probably, on the larger ships. On some of them, almost nothing at all. One of the things that could happen when we have this potential major near-peer conflict is that Navy Reserve helicopters could operate off of Coast Guard ships. Navy operators for the ANSQR 20 who have trained and worked on LCSs, because they have two crews, I presume when we go to war, they won't be rotating out crews, so you'll have those extra crews available. You take those people and put them on Coast Guard cutters along with their sonar systems. So there might be some, you know, additional requirement for funding. And the Navy currently funds our operation out of Bahrain. I think you could probably equip the 36 ships, and the offshore patrol cutter program right now isn't going to be finished until 2034, so it's going to be over a fairly long period. I think you could properly equip the 36 ships for less than you could build five for the Navy. They wouldn't fulfill your needs for normal operations in peacetime, but they could come to your aid in a real serious conflict.
Look, let's talk about a role that the Coast Guard actually has that would be beneficial to the U.S. Navy right now. And that's its ice-breaking capabilities, such as they are. You know, we're looking at the Arctic as opening up due to whatever. And also we've got a lot of issues potentially in Antarctica. Can you kind of discuss the ice-breaking mission? And you know, should this not be something that the DOD is investing more heavily in with the Coast Guard to get some new icebreakers and things?
Okay. Well, the Navy has been helping us with design and contracting for the new icebreakers. Currently, we have one heavy icebreaker and one medium icebreaker. They're both pretty large, about 14,000-15,000 tons. But the medium icebreaker is still in its normal useful life. The heavy icebreaker is way over age right now. And it has been having a lot of maintenance problems. The class has got an awful lot of horsepower, but this other systems have been a little bit troublesome on it. So every year it goes into dry dock. And so it's seriously needs replacing. We send the ship all the way down to Antarctica, and if it breaks down there, there's no U.S. ship that can help it. And since it's one of the most powerful icebreakers in the world, and we go into deeply into Antarctica, where most other nations do not go, it would sit there for a year, probably, until the next summer, when we might be able to get some help. And they're provisioned to do that. But it would be disastrous for our effort in Antarctica. So we have to replace that. And the first one has been funded. It's going to cost less than the original estimate. The original estimate was $1 billion. The contract was for, I think, $745 million, something about that. And the contract is written with options so that we can build three heavy icebreakers for $1.9 billion. So average is about is a little over $600 million apiece, which is about the same as the cost of a national security cutter. They're very big ships. They're going to be 33,000 tons full load. But we won't see the first one until 2023, I think it is. And we won't see all three until about 2027, 2028. Based on a study earlier, we're also planning three medium icebreakers. But that's further down the line, and there's been some discussion that perhaps we ought to just build more of the heavy icebreakers. They are built with weight and space reservation for weapons, but I'm not privy to what that actually involved. There's a lot of space on there. They're going to be about 45,000 horsepower. In some ways simpler than the one they're replacing. But they incorporate newer technology in terms of the propellers and the drive systems and all, so they should be much more reliable. And they have accommodations for like 160 people approximately. We're looking forward to that, but we can't take the current heavy icebreaker out of service until the second one is completed, so that we'll have a rescue capability in case we have a breakdown in Antarctica. And that's probably not going to happen until 2025. So the crew is really, to my mind, somewhat being abused, because they take this long trip down to Antarctica and they come back, and the first thing that happens is, instead of going to, well, they go to their home port for a short period of time, and then they go from Seattle, their home port, to Mare Island, where they're dry docked, and spend most of the time between the previous deployment and the next deployment in dry dock, getting all these very old systems taken care of. Then they rush back to Seattle, load up for the next deployment, and leave. So they're we're asking a lot of them. But I'm a little worried about what may happen in Antarctica. I mean, we've had this treaty that put the claims to Antarctica in abeyance since 1961. And there were several countries have made claims to Antarctica, but they were held in abeyance, and no new claims have been made since the treaty went into effect. But China in particular has been very interested in Antarctica and has put in a lot of work there, building new facilities. They're probably spending more in Antarctica than anybody else right now, and they're building icebreakers too. They may be building, we think they're building a nuclear-powered icebreaker in addition to a conventionally powered one they just recently completed, I think. They had an, earlier they had an old vessel that was taken over from Eastern Europe and made a number of trips to Antarctica and the Arctic. They claim they are a near Arctic country now. And so I think they may want to exploit both the Arctic and Antarctic for its fisheries and mineral wealth. So it will only take one country deciding that they no longer will comply with the treaty and will have a land rush in Antarctica. So I'm a little concerned about that. The U.S. has not made a claim in Antarctica, but it has said it reserved the right to make a claim, as have some other people. There are overlapping claims between the U.S., between the U.K., Argentina, and Chile. Australia has a very large claim, over 41% of the land area of Antarctica is claimed by Australia. Norway, 19%. Argentina has a claim. Chile, the UK, claims 12%. It's going to be interesting if the shit hits the fan, if you know.
Yeah,
but
I thought it'd been one of the more peculiar aspects is, you know, watching China's rise, is China is very much a mid-latitudes nation. And
yes.
they've let themselves know that they aren't a big fan of international agreements that took place before, you know, China had a chance to get through their cultural revolution and all that stuff. But watching a nation like that get interested in the Arctic and the Antarctic, everybody does need to wake up. And that's part of the stew that I'm with you. I've been extremely disappointed with our national lack of enthusiasm of having a effective ice-breaking and ice-capable fleet. The requirements there, in theory, don't need any explanation, but they evidently do. And it is, and I definitely appreciate the fact you stand up for the Coast Guardsmen on those icebreakers, because they're what they're being asked to do in a non-combat situation. I know life isn't fair and all, but they deserve a better fleet than what they've been given. And we've talked, just to switch topics a bit, we've been focusing a lot on some recent improvements in the growing capability of the Coast Guard surface fleet. But they have a very impressive aircraft fleet as well. I believe you mentioned 200 aircraft. Some of the air forces of our friends. Talk a bit about some of the expanded capability and improvements they've had on the air side of the house. And besides, people may know, drug running work and search and rescue, obviously, but some of the other missions that their air service gets to take care of.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we have about 60 fixed-wing patrol aircraft, maritime patrol aircraft, yeah. We have about Most of them are actually C-130s. We're currently replacing the older H models that we have with the J models, which have longer range, and they're faster. I believe we've got about 26 C-130s. We've got 18 HC-144s, which are something about the size of a C-2, a Greyhound. I'm sorry, I might not be right. Okay, but a small twin-engine high wing looks a little bit like a C-130, but it's smaller. And 14 HC-27J Spartans, which are a sort of a twin-engine miniature version of the C-130, but with a lot of capabilities. They look very much, they share systems with the J model of the Super Hercules. But all of those have a Navy-developed electro-optic system and radar called Minotaur, which is also on the P-8. So we have a good capability for surface observation. No capability at all against submarines. In addition, we have 102 865s. They're a medium-size helicopter, twin engine, developed in France. Sort of ironically, the Chinese have the same helicopter. They use it for ASW, though. And we have 45 MH-60 Jayhawks, they call them, which are closer to the Air Force version than they are to the Navy version of the 60. But they can operate from our cutters, but they don't normally. They don't have the hinge in the tail like the Navy H-60s do. So usually it's the smaller helicopter that's on our helicopters, on our ships. But as I said earlier, our ships are certified by the Navy for operation of a number of helicopters, including the MH-60s that the Navy operates.
I've been thinking as you. I mean, we're talking about the benefits for the Navy of the Coast Guard kind of ramping up in some ways with the Navy's help to get to become a more modern and useful auxiliary, as you put it. But from the Coast Guard's point of view, what are the pitfalls of, if any, getting involved in the kind of work the Navy would need you all to do?
Okay. Well, one of the things that does happen is that the Coast Guard is welcome in places in Latin America, particularly where the Navy really isn't, because they see us as non-offensive. You know, we might jeopardize that to some extent. So there is that consideration, like down in Costa Rica. We can go into Costa Rica and replenish. We work with the Costa Rica Coast Guard on a regular basis, but the Navy's not really welcome there. I'm not sure that's going to make too much difference. If you look at how other nations handle Coast Guard type missions, for instance, the British, they have a Coast Guard, but that's mostly a communications system. And then they have a volunteer SAR organization, and the Navy does fisheries and some SAR, and then they contract out some and that sort of thing. So, you know, in there is nothing that really sets the Coast Guard apart from an actual Navy organization in the way it functions internationally in terms of doing law enforcement. Because in a lot of nations, Britain, France, those law enforcement functions are done by the Navy instead of by a Coast Guard. It does seem like a lot of people are seeing benefits to having a Coast Guard organization separate. But, you know, for instance, the Japanese have a civilian Coast Guard, but they're armed, and they take a lot of pride in having sunk a North Korean spy ship. But they are very... they don't have the close association between their Coast Guard and their Navy that we do. India, their Coast Guard is part of the Navy Department, and there's some designs that are shared between the Navy and the Coast Guard in terms of offshore patrol vessels. But they had the Mumbai attack, and that motivated them to really improve their maritime domain awareness, as we call it here. They have a number of radar stations along the coast. They've more than doubled their Coast Guard since that happened, since the attack came via a fishing vessel, really. So there are lots of ways to slice things, but I don't think that we're going to lose the goodwill that we have generally generated. You know, the Coast Guard can operate with the Russian Coast Guard, with the Chinese Coast Guard, more easily than the Navy can operate with their counterparts. So there is that. We have to be careful of that.
Speaking of Japan and how other Navy's Coast Guards, which was kind of fun because that was going to be the next question, but it lead me on to another one, is you know, you always want other people's toys. And every time I see a picture of the new Japanese flying boat, new production, new technology working, in the back of my mind, it drives me a little bad. I go, why don't we have at least two, preferably four, Coast Guard flying boat squadrons? Because I could think from a search and rescue point of view and from a presence operation, especially in many of the smaller islands around the world, but especially Western Pacific, that is really a nice niche capability the Japanese have. From your point of view, am I overplaying my love of other people's toys, or is that a capability that would be nice to have, or are there other nations that have capabilities inside of the roles and missions of our Coast Guard you think would be some nice kit if we could afford it to have in our tool bag?
Well, you know, not only the Japanese have that, but the Chinese and the Russians are also building big flying boats as well. You know, at one time the Navy was building a jet bomber, nuclear bomber, and then became a mine layer to operate out of island bases and that sort of thing. But the Air Force got jealous and said no, and they spanked the Navy about that. But really, the Japanese and the Chinese both have more cutters than we do, and they have some that are bigger than we do. And on the other hand, we have the largest exclusive maritime exclusive economic zone in the world. We and the French are very close. Depends on how you count it. The French have a huge EEZ as well. And so one of the big parts of our EEZ is in the Central and Western Pacific. In fact, that area in Micronesia is bigger than our EEZ in the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico combined. But we haven't been paying too much attention to it until recently. And so it looks like we've started to pay a little more attention. We've been doing some combined ops with Federated States of Micronesia and some of the people there. We've cooperated with the New Zealanders in doing fisheries and trying to stop unregulated, unreported, and illegal fishing, which is a really huge business, and it has the potential of impoverishing these people who rely on it as their primary livelihood. You know, the Chinese have started showing interest in investing in these islands beyond the first island chain. And so we have to pay some attention there, too. And so we've been doing that. Not enough, I don't think, yet. But we are at least moving in that direction. We're going to replace the 210-foot cutters we have in Guam, three of the larger Weber-class 154-foot cutters that I talked about. And they should be able to provide more presence than we have been able to do to this point. The J model C-130s can provide more on-scene time than the H models they're replacing and that sort of thing. So that's happening.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you raised a whole lot of interesting points in your article, and I think that this discussion just highlights that, you know, there's been a degree of sea blindness that Sal and I have talked about for years on this show and other forums, and I think you have too on your blog. So I want to thank you for coming on and talking about this stuff today and kind of filling out some of the information in your blog post. What can we look forward to from you along these lines in the near future? You got some more stuff you're spooling up?
I'd love to come back. We need to replace our 87-foot patrol boat, and I'd like to talk about that sometime. Because I think we need a different concept than what we've had.
There's always more to talk with. And I'll tell you what, Chuck, I really appreciate you coming on today and joining us to talk about the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard future. And look forward to talking to you next time.
Okay, thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, sir.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy and Coast Guard day. Cheers.
You're the best.
It's a long way to the road. It's a long way to the road.